Welcome to the Composer Studio Podcast. On the Composer Studio, we listen to the music of living composers. We talk to them about their writing process, and we learn about the world of music that they live and work in.
I'm Tarek Ghirardella.
And I'm Anna Linville. Today on Composer Studio, we are speaking with composer and multi-instrumentalist Angelica Negron. Angelica writes music for accordions, robotic instruments, toys, and electronics, as well as for chamber ensembles, orchestras, and choir. Negron has been commissioned by the Bang on the Can, All Stars, Lone Bang, Mata Festival, Brooklyn Youth Chorus, So Percussion, the American Composers Orchestra, and the New York Botanical Garden, among others. I just wanted to say thank you so much for reaching out to us, and it's been such a pleasure to get to know your music. We're very excited to have you on.
Thank you.
And I was just telling Tarek before you came on that this was the perfect music for today for me. I needed to listen to this music today. So I'm really happy to share this music with our listeners.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that. I'm assuming it's snowing where you are.
It's not actually, but it's raining. It's raining and the rain is sort of freezing on the branches. And so you have this very viscous rain. Yeah, it's really nice.
It's almost an ice storm is almost what we had down here in North Carolina. But so tell me, you're in New York right now?
I am. Yes, I'm in Brooklyn, and this is where I live. I just returned from 2 months in Puerto Rico, so I'm still in the rough transition, but happy to be back. I'll say that. Yeah,
it's
a lot colder than I would like, but that's life in the diaspora for me. Yeah.
And you were born in Puerto Rico?
I was, yeah. I was born and raised in Puerto Rico, and I moved to New York to pursue a master's. That was almost 15 years ago. So a while ago, this July marks my 15th anniversary with this other island.
Mm. Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah. So you came about 15 years ago. You said it's a bit of a difficult transition when you go back and forth.
Mm-hmm. It is. And yeah, the obvious things, of course, are the weather. I'm still not used to cold weather after such a long time here. But I think there's also this, especially when I spend more time there than just a week or two. This past Christmas, I spent almost 2 months. So it really felt like I was living there again, and everything feels so familiar, and I got into a groove. And then the transition, not only weather-wise, but just not visiting family and not seeing friends, it's tough, but I'm really grateful that I'm a 3-hour and a half flight away. Mm-hmm. So it's not so bad. And that it's also, I also have the privilege of you know, being able to go back and forth when circumstances permit. It was a little tough for this time. But yeah, I don't think I would go to a place that's too far away, because I don't know if I could go without going back to Puerto Rico at least 2 or 3 times a year.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how different is the rhythm of life there?
Yeah, it feels very hectic for me, but I think it's because I have a really big family. Even I'm an only child, but my mom has 8 brothers and sisters, so it's lots of cousins, lots of uncles and aunts. And also most of my friends are there. So it's always, there's always something. And I think also there's something about the soundscape too, that's my experience here in New York, because I'm in a pretty quiet neighborhood in Brooklyn. Whenever I go to Puerto Rico, there's like, it always gets me like the, I don't want to say cacophony, but there's definitely a big contrast in like just sounds that are always pretty loud and always, and it's beyond city sounds. I think it's just, even in my home there, just my mom comes from a really big family. So even though it's just sometimes two or three of us in the house, it's yelling, and it's no one is fighting, and that always gets me. Whenever I'm not there for a while, I go back. I'm like, oh, the volume. It's like, it's definitely up a few decibels here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, Mom, I'm right here. And it's just a few of us. But yeah, I think there's something cultural for sure. And there's also something about people that were raised in a household with many mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. And we're always, you know, trying to to be heard. So mm-hmm. yeah, I'm definitely more of a introvert and quiet person and like my silence and my space. But again, it's this kind of the swaying that happens when you're part of the diaspora. It's like once when you don't have it, then you miss it. And then once you're mm-hmm. there, you complain about it. So I guess it's just part of it.
Well, the first piece we're going to listen to of yours is La Isla Magica. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this actually was inspired by Puerto Rico, but I thought it was a good place to start. It seemed to have some, I don't know, I thought it might have some connection. So I just wanted to know, does that have a connection to Puerto Rico?
Definitely, yeah. La Isla Mágica is very much about the love I have for two islands that are very dear to my heart, one that I've never been to, and another one that is home to me. So it has a lot of influence from Balinese gamelan, and at mm-hmm. the same time, Caribbean rhythms in a way that feels to me very very honest to the sounds I grew up with. I think there's something that I've struggled with in like kind of existential crisis in composer, thinking about how to represent my identity through my music. And mm-hmm. in the sense that I've often been said that my music doesn't sound Puerto Rican or Caribbean. And well, first of all, I've never felt that that's something that any artist owes to people or to a place. But at the same time, as a Puerto Rican and as someone that comes from the oldest colony, and we have such a complex relationship with the U.S. that also makes me think of many other things. And what does it mean to sound Puerto Rican? What does it mean to have a Puerto Rican identity? So I think a lot of my music is not me necessarily trying to address that or answer that question, but is me trying to unpack why that question is always in my head. Mm-hmm. So this piece, in a way, it's one of those early moments in which something clicked, and I was like, I'm just playing, and I'm writing something that I'm excited about, and I'm playing with sounds that feel like they're part of my vocabulary, but at the same time, without thinking about it so consciously, there's an underlying clave, and there are underlying things that are very much part of my Caribbean sensibility, but at the same time, it's not something that I'm consciously thinking, I'm going to take this Afro-Caribbean rhythm and then deconstruct it, or it's not that kind of process. It's more of an intuitive, deeply personal one.
This is La Isla Mágica by Angelica Negron, performed by Eleanor Oppenheim. Thank you. That was La Isla Mágica by composer Angélica Negrón, performed by Eleanor Oppenheim. What a cool piece, Angélica. Just, it's so vibey, you know, and all those rhythms on top of each other and sharing the same amount of space, you know, and all this great all this great motion comes from that, when the bass comes in and all the patterns superimposed over each other. Was there any kind of inspiration for you with all those rhythms? I mean, I know that we spoke a little bit earlier about rhythms from home, but you don't, we're trying not to focus too hard on that. You were just trying to be yourself. Where did the ideas for those rhythms come from?
I think there's a lot of trying to find sounds in my office and in my apartment that I could reimagine and play with. I still have it, a big calculator that makes really cool percussive sounds. So that's in there. There's a stapler, there's a ball too, that's bouncing, a tiny ball. And yeah, I think a lot of the rhythms that come out of it are in a way hidden in those objects, and the gestures kind of dictate also what happens in the piece. So for example, the ball is, you know, it just bounces. So that's already embedded in the gesture is embedded in the object itself. And I see a lot of the other ones similarly, in that there's a certain kind of gesture that happens with my hand when I approach a calculator. There's this kind of reimagining of the objects and putting them in a different context, but at the same time, taking something that feels familiar in my relationship with them to inform the piece as well.
Wow. Do you pre-record all of these noises onto a track, and does the performer have any control over when these noises are played?
For this piece, since this is an early one in like electronics and live performer, this is a pre-recorded track, so the performer is just playing on top of it. And whenever I'm writing something that has electronics, what I do is I approach it and I collect sounds and create a sound bank for that piece. I might use sounds from other sound banks from other pieces, but I like to create kind of like a unique sound world for each piece. And I'm drawn to very similar sounds. So even though it might be a different pot in my kitchen or a different stapler, it's still kind of within that sound world that I'm drawn to. But I think there's something about kind of searching for those sounds as the initial part of the compositional process, collecting and then playing quite literally as a playground, like, what are these sounds want to do?
Are you typically drawn to sounds around the apartment, little things that catch your ear and you're like, ooh, that sounded pretty interesting?
Yeah, that's definitely something I'm really interested in. Kitchen sounds, any object that's quotidian and that has this kind of domestic vibe to it and that feels almost mundane, I'm really drawn to that and to micro sample them and play with kind of abstracting. And in this piece, maybe it's not so much true, but later I've been really interested in abstracting the essence of the sound, or the thing that makes it have that reference in your head of, like, especially in long sustained tones, is the attack, which defines the sound. And then what happens if I just take out the attack and leave the resonance and use that as a pad? actually, I take that back. In this piece, there's a lot of the pads are that way too. It's bell-like tones that it's just playing with the resonance of the object. So it's been many years, but I still always find new objects or new ways of playing the same objects, different mallets, strikers, materials, different ways of approaching it, and or different ways of manipulating it. And I'm amazed that I'm not tired of those sounds yet. That's part of the palette I use. I also do a lot of microsampling of my own pieces, especially orchestral pieces, and lately also microsampling of other people's music, like Latin pop hits from the 90s and things like that. But yeah, I think it's always something about, I'm always looking for something that feels familiar and that has a deep personal connection, but at the same time, I can take that out and then have it transform into something that has its own life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what kind of kid were you? I mean, I'm just trying to imagine Angelica, kind of the introvert in this loud environment, and how you were, are you sensitive to sound? Are you someone who, maybe a little misophonic or something? I'm just curious about your sound world, how you experience sound and how you collect, how you decide, oh, I'm going to start collecting these kinds of sounds for this thing I'm thinking about right now. How does that work?
I am very, very sensitive to sound, and more so as a kid, to a point that it was traumatic in some ways too. Like I remember always asking, I don't want to have balloons in a birthday party. I had control of my birthday party, or I sort of had control. My parents were the boss always, but I did not want balloons because once I heard one pop, I would be like this the whole time because I was anxious about what was the next one that was coming. Same happens to me with fireworks and Christmas time, like especially New Year's Eve in Puerto Rico, and especially where I'm from in Carolina, it's really, 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 really loud. And I think, well, fireworks, the ones that go, that have an anticipation to the sound, and then that's fine. But if it's a loud boom that I can't anticipate, it makes me really anxious. And same with if there are movies that have some sounds that are abrasive, I have a hard time dealing with it. So that's partly why I'm drawn to kind of more tiny, more intimate sounds. But then on the other hand, I think there's also the objects that make those sounds and my personal connection with them. And I remember I collect music boxes now, and the very first music box I had, which is still an object that I have, it's a strawberry shortcake. I don't know if you remember those. Cartoons. So I had a strawberry shortcake music box. I still have it. And that was my first one. And that it's sweet melody, sweet cartoons. But I remember receiving it because this was when I was about 3 years old. I had just lost an aunt with her five kids, and my cousin that had the same age I had, this belonged to her. And I don't have a great memory in terms that I don't remember things very well, but I do remember my grandmother passing along the toys that belonged to the kids. I received this, and this for me was like the presence of my cousin that passed away so young. And I feel like that in a nutshell is kind of why I'm drawn to those sounds too, because they enable me to access parts of my childhood or parts of my past lived experiences that are really hard to verbalize and put into words or to process, or that I'm still trying to unpack. But through sound, then they become something else. And at least for me, it's way easier to understand those things and have those conversations with that language.
Let's move on to the next piece. The next piece is called Panorama, and it's performed by Nick Fotinos. And, so many questions come up about mixing with music that you create synthetically and then blending that with live performance. And even with your own, I know that you're a multi-instrumentalist as well, and I'm sure you have experience doing this too, not just as a composer, but as a performer. And I would love to talk to you a little bit more about that, but let's go ahead and listen to the piece first. And then when we come out, we can go ahead and unpack that, as you say.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
That was Panorama by Angelica Negron, performed by Nick Fotinos. I mean, that piece is, I mean, it just reaches deep into, you know, your heart.
Oh, thank you.
It's so moving. It's so moving. What is the panorama?
This was inspired by road trips that me and my friends do in Puerto Rico mostly to the west coast of the island. So this kind of feeling of being in a car, you're going fast, but everything feels slow. And there's this kind of eerie calmness by just seeing the landscapes, and the colors and textures, and feeling the breeze like in your face and hair. And there's that side of it, which is the main inspiration of it, but also panorama as in something that is trying to have a broader view of a situation, which could be, you know, anything, but thinking particularly of a kind of longing or a very, very deep need to take yourself out of a situation and see the whole picture, to approach it with more clarity and presence. Mm-hmm. So there's those two sides of that, because I find myself drawn to the feeling of presence that I have when I'm in those landscapes, especially from the perspective of being in a car and admiring them and seeing the vastness of them. I find myself using that as a technique for grounding myself when I need that. Mm-hmm.
We were chatting while we were listening to the last piece, and I had mentioned to you that even before we had spoken, I had the impression that your music was so personal, so deep. And I was just curious, you know, when you sit down to compose, and because your music is so personal, is it something that you labor over? Or is it the complete opposite, where it just pours out and you don't get in its way? You just let it come out and go onto the page or into the program and just let it be what it's going to be?
I wish it was the latter. I think every piece feels like a huge struggle for some reason, but with some distance, again, talking about this ability to, which is hard sometimes to see things from a distance. Now hearing it, I'm like, wow, I remember like being really stressed about that deadline. But now hearing it, there's an easiness to it that I wish felt like that in my body and brain when I was composing it. But I think there, even within that, there's pieces that are more challenging birds than others. I feel Panorama and also La Isla Mágica were early on in a process of me kind of defining what is now what I feel it feels like the sound world I want to live in, at least for now. And at that point, it was more exploration and more like kind of grabbing onto things desperately that felt right, but still nervous about what that meant, because I was still coming from being a student, I was also still a student in doctoral program and feeling very out of place writing this music in those spaces. I mean, I was not bringing this music to the composer seminar in my PhD, but that precisely was the problem, I think, that I was struggling with. Mm-hmm. Was like, then why am I devoting so much time to something in my life if I don't feel welcome, or I feel like I shouldn't be writing the music that I want to write? So I think there's a lot of existential struggle in those pieces. Mm-hmm. But that a lot came out of it in terms of how I now feel a kind of, not comfort, but a sense of home in a way, and familiarity in a way that feels like I'm challenging myself, but at the same time, I'm doing something that I deeply care about, not something that is just putting notes on a page to talk mm-hmm. about in a composition seminar, and it sounds interesting, when we talk about it, but there's no heart in it. At least my heart wasn't in it.
Mm-hmm. May I ask you a technical question here?
Yep.
With a piece like this, where you're blending live performance with a pre-recorded material, how do you organize it? How do you put it together? What is the violinist looking at and listening to, and what other parts of the performance are we not hearing? Like, is there a click track involved or any of those other formats to keep everything on pace?
Yeah, good question. Well, first thing for me is that a lot of my music that has electronics, 99% of those electronics come from an acoustic source that has been manipulated, so it's not synthesized sound. I've been exploring a little more of that actually this past year, but before that, it was almost entirely all acoustic sources. And so there's a kind of natural blend that happens between the live instrument and the track, even if the track is not interactive and it's pre-recorded. And then I'm always striving for them feeling like not one on top of the other, but like they're together this one super instrument. So I try my best not to write pieces that need click track. That depends on the performer. I know that this piece has been performed with click track and without click track. It's more of I give the option to the performer, but it's meant to be performed. To be able to be performed without it.
Nice.
I mean, maybe it's something of the performer or film scorer in me that it really hates that sound. So mm-hmm. It's not, especially a piece like this, it's not really conducive to like the most heartfelt performance, but yeah. No, there are people that are really good at it and are not annoyed by that. So that's also a personal thing. Mm-hmm. But I think there's, I try my best not for it to be able to have things in the music and in the score that are cues that could make it for more, I'm thinking musical, but you can't mm-hmm. be musical with a click track. I'm not saying you can't, but something that there's not another layer in between these two things, the electronics mm-hmm. and the live performer, because ultimately I want it to sound like one thing.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. I can't imagine trying to perform and really put my emotions into it if there was a click track. It's like performing with a metronome. I mean, basically that's what it is. So,
right.
It would make you feel like when I perform with a metronome, that's when I'm practicing and I'm not performing with a metronome. I'm practicing. I'm getting the timing down. And then I would just kind of throw away the strict time of the metronome, the binding restrictions. Mm-hmm. And so I can't imagine how hard it must be to actually create something emotional with a click track.
Yeah,
but
it's a balancing act for sure. I mean, there are pieces that I've written mm-hmm. that there's no other way around them, that, mm-hmm. that you have to have click track. But I try my best to avoid it. But it's when you're incorporating live performers with things that are either pre-recorded or that need some other sync system, then sometimes it's unavoidable.
We're going to move on to your next piece, Drawings by Mayoko. And this piece is performed by a trio. And I wanted to ask before we listen to it, what are some of the things that you have to think about making the transition from writing the music, the kind of music that we just listened to, where it blends, for lack of a better term, electronic music with live performance, now to a trio of all acoustic instruments? What kinds of things do you have to think about that take you to a different direction?
Well, this is the piece that kind of changed everything. It was the first piece, I think, that I wrote that really felt like I was being honest with myself. And it happened in 2009 in my transition between my master's and my doctorate. I took a year off, and it was the first time I was writing music for myself and not showing it to anyone. And I say music for myself in the sense that, like concert music, I was in bands. That's how I started writing music. So that was for myself and for my friends. But music, like concert music, this was the first time that I was not bringing it to someone and saying and talking about it in through an academic lens. So I remember starting this piece many, many, many times. and being incredibly frustrated by it. And then it was like 2 days before the deadline. And at that time, I composed at the piano and by hand, finale on the computer. And I remember thinking that's what I thought composers do. But I was writing a lot of ambient music and music for my band with, at that time, pre-Ableton. It was Fruity Loops for me. I don't know if you are familiar with that, but it's a software for making electronic music. And I really didn't like the sounds that it came with, but it had a sampler function to it, or like you could load your own samples. And I remember recording things on a tape recorder, like super lo-fi, and then putting those in, or taking a recording of an orchestral reading of A Piece of Mine and then putting it there and then taking a second from it and then playing around with those. And I knew of Fruity Loops because I'm from Carolina, which is a place in Puerto Rico, which is known as the birth town of reggaeton. And everyone that makes reggaeton still uses, a lot of people use Fruity Loops. I remember going to the music store and they would sell the computer with Fruity Loops, like reggaeton ready for you.
Wow.
So that's how I knew about it. And I was making ambient music before, but that was not the music I was bringing to school or writing for performers in that sense. So this was kind of a turning point of out of that complete desperation of like the deadline is 2 days away. I need to figure out something. And I approached it as if I was not writing something for my band or something for my solo ambient project. And everything sort of made sense from then on. Yeah.
Nice. Well, let's go ahead and listen to it now. This is Drawings for Mayoko, performed by the Janos Trio. Noiko Wadden, harp, Amanda Baker, flute, and Beth Myers, viola. Thank you.
That was Drawings for Miyoko by Angelica Negron. Angelica, it's so fascinating to me that, you know, all these mundane things that you use can be, you know, evoke something so different. So, you know, in the mind of a listener, I mean, you said that that kind of dragging, there was like a crinkling, dragging sound. To me, it sounded like either rain on a roof or like somebody dragging something over rough ground. And you said it was just crumpling paper.
It is. It's crumpling paper. That's a little bit on the track, but also the live performers are also doing that. I'm always trying to find ways to bridge the electronics and the performers together.
So cool. Oh, yeah, that's really interesting. So what does the performance of this piece look like normally? Or is there a normal for this kind of performance?
This one, I wrote it for Janus Trio, and I was very lucky. They're incredibly talented, but also multi-instrumentalist. And I knew them as friends, and I knew they had lovely voices. So I knew I wanted to write something for their voices as well. And Beth, the viola player, she also plays banjo. So I wanted to write a part for banjo too. So it's pretty specific, and I knew that that could become an issue later for future performances. But what I found with this and other similar pieces in which I write something very specific, that I just have to remember to be flexible about different approaches to the piece. So, for example, it might be that the viola player in the future performance doesn't play banjo, but that we find a way to evoke a banjo-like sound through the playing pizzicato in the viola. Mm-hmm. So I think of those as fun challenges, and especially if you are working with performers that are game to trying out those things, it's really fun to figure out together how to not recreate something that we don't have, but to get to a similar place or evoke this similar texture.
Do you find that often performers are very willing and eager to try new things that you come up with, or are they sometimes hesitant?
I feel very lucky that I've had really good experiences with performers. It's also part why I love working with solo performers and chamber music. It's not the same for larger ensembles. Because of the nature of the medium and the huge amount of resource that it takes to bring those people together, there are other things that come into play and in dynamics that I'm not so thrilled about, combined with, you know, in big institutions and many years of practices that might not be the most inclusive for people that look like me. So I think this is one of the main reasons why I fell in love with chamber music and with writing for friends, which a lot of these pieces, well, all of the pieces that we're hearing right now, I wrote for friends. And it was kind of the perfect playground to coming from an existential crisis compositionally. It was a really perfect setting for me to try new things, to really work with them one-on-one, and then find out what I wanted to say, because I was very lost before that, sonically speaking.
Yeah, and I think the challenge is, you know, I think that there is a kind of reckoning going on with, you know, what is music for, and what is it expressing for us now, and I think a lot of composers are struggling with, you know, they're having existential struggles, not just because maybe it's also just because we're different, and the concert hall isn't maybe the medium or the platform that works for us anymore, you know?
Yeah, that's a really point. Yeah, the spaces in which this music exists and the containers and that hold it. Yeah, mm-hmm. I've been thinking a lot about that in the past few years, and obviously we've all been thinking about it a lot last year. But yeah, those spaces come with a lot of great things, and also with not so great things and barriers to access. And I think it's important to consider those also as part of the experience. If, at least for myself, if I'm after something else, then I need to also reconsider the spaces in which the music is happening.
You wrote a piece for So Percussion called Gone. That is a really great piece. Awesome sounds and rhythms again. But I wanted to ask you, as a performer, what draws you to percussion sounds, and do you play percussion?
I grew up as a violinist, but I never felt like a violinist. I was just very curious, banging around things in my house, and also in the conservatory. I started to teach myself other instruments and take lessons on other instruments, harp, was one I fell in love with and that I love writing for as well. And I always say that if I were a harpist from the beginning, that maybe I wouldn't have been a composer because the hours just passed so quickly as I was practicing. But one of the things that I fell in love with the harp was the percussion possibilities of it, and finding all the sounds, like in all the different spots in the harp, the soundboard, below the soundboard, when you hit the string with the nail or with a different part of your finger or with an object. So I feel like I'm not a percussionist, but I'm always banging on things and always thinking of, okay, I need to sample that and I need to record that. So my approach to crafting electronics comes from a percussive perspective because it's sampling things that I can hit, shake, or strike. So there, that's just there always. And I think going back to GOM, so percussion is, it's one of those groups that really, that were really formative. And when I found them, and I think through them, actually, it's when I discovered Bang on a Can. It was kind of one of those life-changing moments of, oh, this is a percussion quartet, but they sound like a band. But wait, do I care about that distinction? And I think that right there sums up a lot of what I'm after. And it's just a dream to get to write for them too.
We're going to go ahead and listen to Gone by Angelica Negron. This is performed by So Percussion, Eric Chabich, Josh Quillen, Adam Suwinski, and Jason Truding.
That was Gone by Angelica Negron, performed by So Percussion. So Angelica, what are you working on right now? What's going on?
I am currently working on music for a documentary about the injustices that people that are in ICE detention centers are still facing, but this particular documentary looks at the beginning of COVID and the lack of safety measures in detention centers. So I'm in the middle of scoring that, and it's pretty intense in that I have to take more breaks than usual because it's very emotionally draining. But whenever I'm feeling that, I remind myself that I'm very lucky, I'm composing, I'm in a safe place. And I am writing a piece for the LA Philharmonic in the next few months, and another one for the Seattle Symphony, and one for the Louisville Orchestra too. So it's a big orchestral year. I never thought I would have a career in orchestral music. It's been happening more. And I think now because of COVID and some shifting in the schedule too, I just ended up with three big orchestral commissions for this year. But I'm excited about it. And I also just wrapped up a really exciting project, a digital commission with Opera Philadelphia, which is a kind of satellite exploration of an opera I've been working on for the past 3 years, a lip sync opera for drag queens. So we just made a film that we did last year for that. And it's with one of my favorite drag queens, and I still can't remember. I still can't believe it's happening. Still pitching myself, but it's happening, and that will be out on March 18th on the Opera Philadelphia That's channel. Awesome. They're doing really incredible things and reimagining what opera is right now.
They are really doing amazing things.
That's really fascinating. I'm curious about the orchestra pieces. You know, orchestra compositions are traditionally just orchestra, but you always seem to have an extra element to your music in preparation and pre-recording. And I was wondering if you plan to do that same kind of treatment with the orchestra pieces.
That's a good question. I recently finished a piece which was premiered a few days ago by the Dallas Symphony. I was a composer in residence that never went to Dallas because it was a COVID residency. But for that one, it was acoustic mostly, and then I had the piano player play a MIDI keyboard with some samples that I provided. So there are some electronic textures that are being played live. I've never done pre-recorded electronics with orchestra, but I usually I get the loophole that I find is the keyboard player. And I'm like, okay, sure, you can play piano, celesta, and also this MIDI keyboard with all of my sounds. So I'm still, every time I do it, I know I'm not sure if it's a good decision, because especially if I'm not there, it's levels and balance. It's always really tricky because electronics are always too loud for orchestras. I found, and they're never loud enough for me, but that said, I still don't know for these three pieces. I do know that for the LA Phil piece, I want to approach it as micro sampling with the orchestra, but without electronics. But thinking of the orchestra as like if it were my sampler instrument in Ableton in a way, right? And kind of seeing what happens if I try to manipulate it and process it in a similar way that I would a found sound or a sample. So that's exciting to me about that one. And I've been thinking a lot about West Side Story. And I mean, this is just kind of like really, really behind the scenes of that LA Phil piece, because it's not going to be in the forefront. But at this early stage, I've been thinking a lot about what would happen if I just deconstruct West Side Story from the perspective of a Puerto Rican composer, not trying to fix it, not being like, oh, that part right there was actually Spanish music. That's not really Puerto Rican music. Let me show you what it is. I'm not interested in that. But like, what would happen if I take that as part of like the, I don't want to say necessarily inspiration, but just like my creative impulse to say something about my identity as a Latina composer, mm-hmm. navigating now in these mostly white spaces and that I never thought I would be a part of, especially with orchestra.
Angelica, I want to thank you so much for being on the Composer Studio today. It was such a joy to be able to learn about you, to talk with you, and to hear your music.
Thank you so much, both. This was super fun.
We're going to close with a piece of yours called Neblina that is performed by you. And I know that you're a multi-instrumentalist, and we've been meaning to talk to you about that the whole show. And I would love for you to just close us out describing all the instruments that you play, how you learned them, and a little bit about this piece as well.
So I grew up playing violin and then studied a little bit of harp and cello. I taught myself how to play the accordion, which is what I mostly play now. And besides that, I've also been really interested in finding ways to make the performance of electronic music more engaging in life. And through that journey, I found myself playing plants and vegetables and robotic modules that actually were accompany so percussion and gun, those robotic modules. But yeah, I like to always change the instruments I'm playing. And especially when I'm playing live electronics, those parts could easily be played by a MIDI keyboard, pretty straightforward. But I'm really interested in what happens when I change the interface to something that's like a plant that's, and I'm mapping leaves to specific sounds, and what does that do to the compositional process and performance. And yeah, so I'm always kind of changing up my instruments. I get bored really easily. And Neblina is a track that has a lot of electronics that again come from an acoustic source, but it also has a lot of layers of my broken violin, and which I tend to use more detuned than tuned. And yeah, I think Neblina holds a very special place for me. I find myself going to those textures and sounds often, and that was one of the starting places of that, especially pieces like Panorama, I think, are born out of Neblina existing.
This is Neblina, performed and written by Angelica Negron. You have been listening to the music of Angelica Negron on the Composer Studio. If you enjoyed Angelica's music, you can find more of it at www.angelicanegron.com/music. We hope you've enjoyed the show.
We want to hear from you. Have you discovered new music that moves you? Share it with us. Are you a composer who would like to be featured on the show? Get in touch. Just want to tell us what a great job we're doing? Tweet us, leave us a comment on our Facebook page or Instagram. Even send us an email. And if you have a minute, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. And this week, we want to leave you with a thought from Jan Sibelius that really kind of seemed to fit with Angelica's music. And that is, music begins where the possibilities of language end.